I know I've said this before, but every so often I'll have somebody reach out to say, hey, I'm kind of in a bind with the hospital, usually through their internal peer review system, or worse, it's actually gone through medical legal litigation. And so I get asked to review it just to kind of opine, there's that word again, opine, such a great word, to opine on the standard of care or the quality of care that a provider gave. Now, in this particular case that we're going to review, again, don't worry, no names, no hospital affiliation going to be disclosed. Can't do that at all, of course. And I think it needs to be said here, just out of my own transparency, I do these reviews for the defense, for the defendant, for the person who's in review trying to see, try to bail him out. Okay, so if you did something right, I'll be in your corner again, fighting for it if it's worth fighting for. But just to be clear, I don't usually do for the other side, which is picking my finger and going, you did something incorrect, it's your fault. No, no, no. I never want a colleague to do that for me. And so I usually try to find something defendable if it's defendable based on current practice and best technique and the data. But I just wanted to say that this is my typical MO, is that if I feel it's something that I can fight for, then I will. But I'm usually not trying to find fault on anybody. That's not my mojo. That's not what I'm trying to do. But this does not happen here at my local institution. So I want to be very clear. This is not somebody in my own institution, though it could happen anywhere. So this practitioner who knows me very peripherally, I don't know them personally, but I think I met them once or twice at a professional meeting, and they follow the social media stuff, which, surprise, we're talking about this on the podcast. But I was asked, hey, look, can you please do this as an independent third-party reviewer and basically come to my defense? And of course, hey, if you're defendable, I'm in your corner, because somebody needs to fight for evidence-based practice. Well, I said I'd be happy to take a look at it. You know, of course, you know, I got to be fair to the data. I'm not on your side. I'm not on the hospital side. I'm on the side of the child, and what is typical and good clinical practice. So this provider said, absolutely, no question. So I received the record from the hospital and their peer review system, and no, it was not. So flags came up right away. And then my response was, no, this kind of deviated from good clinical practice. Probably not the response that this physician was looking for. But here's what happened. Short of it is, there was a child at 35 weeks going through labor, and there was a prolonged second stage, not an abnormally prolonged, because it was a primogravida with an epidural. Remember, ACOG says that there's 3 up to 4 hours allowed as long as the maternal fetal condition is okay, mom desires to continue, and there's progressive fetal descent. So this pregnant patient was about 2 hours and 40 minutes into her second stage and was just kind of exhausted, like, I'm done. Totally understandable, of course. Well, to prevent PTSD and a terrible experience, of course, the physician said, let me go ahead and I will help with this procedure. Now, a couple of things were noted here right off the bat. First, the grading of the descent was on a 3/3 scale, which we haven't used in a long, long time, because now, of course, the maternal pelvis and the birth canal is graded in terms of fifths, so that the outlet is 5 out of 5. No need to separate the labia. A scalp is visible at the introitus, and the scalp has reached the pelvic floor. We all get that, right? It is a 5 out of 5 system. So FYI, and not what we're talking about here, but if you're still using a 3/3 system, way outdated, right? It's not broken up into thirds, it's broken up into fifths. So this provider said, well, this was an outlet because it was 3 out of 3 station. Well, okay, wait a minute. What? If it's 3 out of 5, then that's a low vacuum. And if you mean outlet, then it should be 5 out of 5. So that was the first flag. Like, no, wait a minute. Our terms are not in line with current ACOG and universal nomenclature. So that's the first. Okay, I already got a little flag. Then the provider did one attempt, and it did pop off, which happens. It's okay. Or the more formal way would be to say it had a cup detachment. Okay, fine. But there was still some descent, so it was okay. Then the nurse said, oh my gosh, look at that's a pretty swollen little head there. The provider palpated the head and said, oh, that's just a caput. It's no worries. Then reapplied the vacuum in a different location. Y'all following me here? In a different location. FYI, there's only one position to place the vacuum, which is called the flexion point. So again, so right now, so my little anal sphincter, as I'm reading this and the nurse's notes, again, I don't know these people, okay, personally, but the nurse in the room, very well documented in a non-throwing you under the bus way. Just matter of fact, physician palpated the scalp, said that the overt and visible swelling that was fluctuant, all of these were the terms that were used, was just cap it and then reapply the vacuum in a different spot. Not only did he reapply it in a different spot, but he told everyone, I'm going to apply it in a different spot. Here's my medical response to that. Huh? Guy, you only got one spot to put the damn thing on. It's called the flexion point. But I digress. None of this, by the way, is what I'm focusing on. Short of it is, applied it in a different spot. Traction, baby was delivered. Okay, fine. Well, baby comes out, has low Apgars, needs PPV, starts looking a little dusky. Like, what is happening? Well, head started getting a little boggy, a little squishy. Guys, it was a subgaleal bleed. Now, did y'all catch that? This was a subgaleal bleed, which is impressive and dangerous in and of itself. Because even though it's rare, we're going to go through the numbers here in a minute, this could potentially, if not diagnosed correctly, could be fatal for the child. Yeah, kids die from this shortly within the first 24 hours of life, okay? But the reason this was impressive is because this was diagnosed when the baby was in the warmer getting his initial resus. Like, oh, this baby's kind of dusky. Ooh, head's feeling kind of weird. It was diagnosed within minutes of birth. This is why this is important, because typically subgaleal hemorrhages accumulate over the first few hours of birth. It's a small venous bleed. It takes a while to fill the space. It has to dissect the connective tissue. So it's found at 2, 4, 6, 8 hours, up to 12 hours after the vacuum attempt. So, and this is what we're focusing on. This was evident within the first few minutes. In other words, it's a pretty drastic bleed, okay? So this is why we're talking about this in this episode, because it's rare. It can happen spontaneously, guys. How scary is that? But it's really rare in that case. And the single biggest factor here for subgaleal bleed in a newborn, and we're going to discuss the different kinds of bleeding, what acephalal hematoma is compared to caput succedaneum, of course, to a subgaleal bleed, to an epidural or subdural hematoma. We're going to talk about these and what a chignon is. Cool word, the chignon. But why it's super important to identify this correctly. So any child born by vacuum should be observed. The critical time is the first 12 hours. Thankfully, this does not always happen after a vacuum. But there are some flags here that can increase its development. Number of pulls, based on some studies. Number of detachments, based on some studies. And inappropriate placement, the majority being very close to the anterior fontanelle. So we're going to discuss proper cup placement. Whether that's a rigid cup, like the little mushroom, or a soft like a bell. Doesn't matter. You got to place it over. There's just one spot to place it, and that's the flexion point. So we're going to discuss all of this. So I thought, you know, after I wrote back this rebuttal of, wait, what happened? It was replaced in a different spot. Well, either the second time was right and the first time was wrong, or vice versa, but it doesn't matter. You can only place it in one spot. Now, it's impossible to say that absolutely caused the subgaleal hemorrhage. However, it sure is likely. And the reason I say that is because, again, subgaleal hemorrhage can totally happen by itself in a second stage. But with two placements and a misplacement, one of those was placed incorrectly, okay, because he put it in a different position. Y'all follow that, right? And this quick feel while still in the introitus of this really weird kind of spongy wave-like mass, which is how the nurse described it in the nursing notes, makes you think, well, that wasn't there before the cup placed. It was there after the first cup detachment. Sure looks like it to me. So again, this was all anonymous, right? I'm not giving any names or locations, but I thought this was super important because we do vacuum pretty regularly. I mean, it's not like every day, but with the appropriate indication, vacuum is used, just like forceps are used. And it's something we kind of take for granted. Well, this case, which highlights the fact that bad stuff can happen. I mean, this actually happened in February of this year. This is why we've got to, one, respect the procedure, two, know what we're doing, and then three, have this open communication that when a child goes through either a low vacuum, outlet vacuum, doesn't matter, a vacuum-assisted and instrumental delivery, have that child observe for the first 12 hours, which are critical, even though it's rare, because things can happen. And if it's caught too late, it can be deadly. So in this episode, we're going to talk about the fetal subgaleal bleed or hemorrhage. Let's do that now. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Before I give you the numbers, this reminds me of something that I've just got to say. Look, if you want me to review some kind of file or you ask your hospital to send it to me or whatever, because it's all got to be through HIPAA, guys, okay? Please don't send me, like, stuff on your phone. Don't want to see it. But if you want me to, like, review something, whatever, and I got the time, then I'm all for it. But please make sure that you did something legit and it just kind of happens, because sometimes malocclusion happens, and it doesn't mean malpractice, right? That was a Dr. Cunningham thing from Williams Obstetrics when he was, God bless him, still at Southwestern, at Parkland. Malocclusion sometimes happens, and it doesn't mean malpractice. However, if you do something wrong, it greatly increases your risk of malocclusion. So I felt so bad because I was like, man, I thought like I was going to find nothing. This guy was super confident. Like, I don't know what happened. I'm like, bro, you put the vacuum on two different parts of the baby's head. Why? Why did you do that? And I can't say for sure that this happened, but it sure does sound suspicious. And this kid got sick. And you felt something that was weird. I mean, if you feel something weird, that's where you abandon. Go, look, I don't know what's going on. I don't want to miss a subgaleal bleed. There's something weird here. Let's just stop. But to reposition on a different part, there's only one part. Oh, my goodness. Whew, I don't think that was the answer this poor guy was looking for. But anyway, got to stick with the facts. I remember watching as a kid reruns of the old, what was the name of that show? Dragnet. It was, y'all remember, y'all have no idea what I'm talking about. Dragnet was a detective show. I think they were like in LA, LA County or something. And it was two very, very stiff-laced detectives. Come on, man, Dragnet. I even think, Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd, they redid that, in the 80s? It was a great comedy then, but the original show, Dragnet, was not a comedy. It was just the facts. I just want just the facts, man. You don't have to remember Dragnet?
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Well, we just wasted like a minute doing that. Let's get back to the program. Thank you for being part of our podcast family. We really are grateful and thankful that you've chosen to take this journey of medical education with us. You're listening to Clinical Pearls. You know, I kind of hesitated whether I was going to do this topic or not, because the last thing that I want to imply is that, oh my gosh, vacuums are terrible or forceps are from Satan. You know, no, hey, these are wonderful tools when used correctly and when they're indicated. which raises a separate point. Some time ago, somebody had asked, hey, is it okay that I routinely, just, you know, without indication, just routinely at time of C-section, apply a vacuum and do a vacuum-assisted delivery through the hysterotomy? That was somebody's question. It actually wasn't that long ago. It had to be maybe like a year ago. And I was like, hey, number one, you do you. Two, there's no data for that. While there's some opinions that have been published and very small little cohort studies are like, hey, this is fine. Didn't seem to cause any issues. So, and that's what they based their decision on, to routinely use a vacuum in the cephalic delivery at a hysterotomy at C-section. It's still an instrumental delivery. Any time that you use an instrument, there should be an indication. Traditionally, vacuum or like the coin spoon, forceps have been used at hysterotomy when it's a difficult extraction, mainly with the undescended fetal head, the floating head, which is most of the reasons that an instrument is used at hysterotomy. But just electively, like I just do it all the time, you're looking for problems because all it takes is one bad placement, too much pressure, a weird detachment, or whatever, and it raises the risk. So again, I'm not trying to throw anybody into the bus. If you routinely do a vacuum without an indication at C-section and it's working for you, okay. Just be careful because that's not what is typical practice, right? Typical practice is you do fundal pressure called the Hillis maneuver and you guide the baby's head out and it squishes out like a popped pimple. It just happens. It's not that difficult. But it's nice to have these rescue things if it's needed. So I've done vacuum-assisted cesarean birth when I can't get the head. I mean, man, I can't, like, it's not flexed, it's floating. Or the other option there is not use any instrument at all, is to go in and grab the feet, just do an internal podalic version, grab the feet and pull it out. That's actually, in some studies, that's actually less morbid than using an instrument. All to say, to use it electively just because that's what you do, probably not the wisest, right? Because that's not, again, there's no guidance that says in all of the evidence-based C-section protocols that I've read, and there have been some great ones that have been published through Clark. Well, Gabby had some in the past. Dalk, and we've covered that in this episode, whether it's a single-layer, two-layer closure. We've done all of that in this episode. Nowhere in there does it say the routine use of a vacuum or forceps at hysterotomy without even trying manual seems to be the best. No one has that. It always defaults to a rescue maneuver, right? And I don't mean rescue like something's wrong. It's just you got to do something. So, or a secondary maneuver, I guess I should say. There is a systematic review on this very thing, using it kind of electively at C-section without indication, that was published in 2020. And here's what the authors found after a review of this subject and in the published data. Again, 2020 was a year of publication. Quote, although several studies of cesarean deliveries have recognized vacuum assistance for fetal extraction as a simply equipped, effective, and beneficial method of fetal head delivery, further research is required to clarify the safety of vacuum assistance in cesarean deliveries, end quote. In other words, it doesn't say not to do it. It says do it when you really have to do it. But to do it electively, there's just no data that's a thing. I like how Stephen Clark put this in a 2008 publication that was published in the Gray Journal. Dr. Clark wrote, quote, the use of either forceps or a vacuum device to assist in delivery of the fetal head at cesarean delivery is a well-established and accepted part of obstetrical practice. Now, here it is, guys. When the delivery is found to be difficult and a traumatic manual delivery is not possible. End quote. In other words, hey, use a vacuum, use the coin spoon, use the vacuum at C-section when it's indicated. All right. All to say is that you wouldn't apply a vacuum just because in the vagina. And I know some people in academics are like, oh, oops. Well, that's how we train, especially with an outlet, which is that baby's like right there. And we're just going to affect delivery. And, you know, the intern gets a little vacuum out of it. I get that. The lowest chance of harm is when the baby is like basically already out. All right. This is plus five. And, you know, it's already crowned. You're like, hey, quick, get the vacuum and flex it a little bit and help that baby's head come out. I get that. That's called an elective outlet for maternal relief. If there's a lot of pressures, you just can't push that little part out. And I get that that's done. But it makes the point of just just like you wouldn't use it routinely, electively, without indication at a vaginal delivery, why would you do it electively, routinely at C-section? So anyway, just throwing that out there, that's not what we're talking about here. This was a vaginally assisted operative vaginal delivery with a vacuum. And even though it doesn't really matter, in this case, it was a rigid, it was a mushroom cap, not the bell, but that doesn't matter. In some studies, if you just want to know, the bell seems to be less room for slippage. That little sucker will stick on very nicely, but potentially some increased risk of scalp or skin or subcutaneous tissue injury. But otherwise, deeper structures seem to have the same effect, whether it's the soft or the rigid cup, right? So whether it's the bell or the mushroom cup, for things like this that we're going to talk about outside of initial scalp lax, it really doesn't seem to be an issue. What seems to matter is length of total vacuum time, so never go more than 15 to 20. That's the max of continuous of added vacuum time and or number of pulls or pop-offs. So anyway, now that we've laid all that, and none of that was in my outline. I don't know where I went there, but what I wanted to focus on is this issue of subgaleal bleed. All right, it's also a great review for the boards because everybody gets cephalohematoma. That's not linked to anything except you get a cone head. Chignon is always a good one that people will throw out. Explain to me the management of a chignon. Watch it, look at it. Don't put a cap on it so you can keep an eye on it. But in terms of severe morbidity or needing a transfusion, that's not going to happen. And we'll discuss that in a minute. But this is one that we got to get right when they say, what about subgaleal hemorrhage? Ooh, now you go, well, number one, I would poop myself. That's step one. Number two is change yourself from the poop that you just did. Number three is to follow that baby super closely and get on top of it, which includes blood factor replacement if needed and blood products and intravascular resuscitation. Because there's no way to stop that joker until it stops by itself. How scary is that? So not like you can put in an injection, put in a sealant. You got to wait for that to somehow tamponade itself, and it can be a lot of volume, guys. Okay, now, I feel bad for this little kid. I feel bad for the parents. I don't know what happened to the child. It got transferred to some other hospital. I don't know if it survived. I have no idea. I don't know. But the morbidity comes from hypovolemic shock. That's how it leads to encephalopathy. That's how it leads to neuronal death. That's how it leads to true traumatic cerebral palsy, is because you're not perfusing. So that's why you've got to get ahead of this, is blood transfusion, IV fluids, keep blood going to the baby's melon so it perfuses, because that blood volume is getting lost into the skin. Crazy, right? So subgaleal hemorrhage is not to be taken lightly. Cephalohematoma, you're like, interesting. Okay, that's going to tamponade itself off. Outside of maybe a little connectuous issue, I'm okay with that. Caput succedaneum, again, nothing. You just got a cone head and, you know, take pictures once that thing resolves or put a cap on that thing. And a chignon, very benign, although it looks kind of funny because it's a very circular little mountain. And again, we'll talk about that in a minute. But this is the bad one. This is the one, subgaleal hemorrhage is one you got to look out for. And let me be very clear here. Before we go on, listen to this, guys. Is it possible that there is a vacuum that is used that is effortless? It doesn't pop off. It takes like 30 seconds. Boop, baby's head just kind of delivers. Everything's fine. And then this happens. Absolutely. And in that case, you're like, hey, man, I did everything by the book. It was on the flexion point. I didn't cause rocking of the cup. It was below 15 minutes because it was like a minute at max or 30 seconds. And it was effortless single maneuver delivery. Now, the chance that that leads to a subgaleal hemorrhage is pretty small because there was no issues there. But it is possible. So I'll be very clear. Just because this happened does not mean somebody jacked up the procedure. Okay? Just to be clear, it does not mean that. So it can happen. However, if there are things that are not done correctly, it greatly increases the relative risk of it happening. Does that make sense? And the reason we know that everything can be done correctly and this thing still occur, this pain in the ass, subgaleal hemorrhage, are you kidding me? Is because it's happened at C-section. Now, it's not going to happen at C-section. That's scheduled. It's typically at second stage arrest or some kind of intrapartum issue. And then it happens. And then, oh my gosh, by the way, we found a subgaleal hemorrhage. Even with an atraumatic manual delivery of the baby's head through the hysterotomy. So it can happen. It's just when I give you what I'm going to do next, the numbers don't lie, guys, because study after study after study has shown that this occurrence is greatly increased with vacuum. That's number one. Number two, number of pulls. Number three, number of cup detachments. Number four, total vacuum time. Number five, bad placement. Do y'all get that? So if you're ever asked, hey, does subgaleal hemorrhage in a child mean something went south? So that doesn't mean that the procedure was done incorrectly. No, not at all. But the relative risk is there. I mean, it definitely helps to do it wrong in order to get this. It's just like clavicular fracture. If you have a child that has abnormal delivery, like no shoulder dystocia, it just kind of happens. And then NICU calls you back like, hey, this kid's not moving the arm too well. I just want to let you know there's like a non-displaced little fracture of the clavicle on one side. So your first question is, which side was it? Because was it the side that was in back of the symphysis? And typically that's yes. Oh, okay. Well, maybe it just kind of got hung up there and the normal transmission forces of birth can do it if it was an atraumatic birth process. Although, once again, shoulder dystocia and traumatic manipulation can increase its risk of happening. Does that make sense? So it's the same thing here. Subgaleal hemorrhage can happen by itself, just like clavicular fracture can happen as part of normal labor. It can. However, more manipulation, multiple attempts, incorrect use of things, whether it's shoulder dystocia maneuvers, or in this case, incorrect use of a vacuum or forceps, greatly increases its risk. I'm going to give you those numbers in a minute, okay? The other thing I wanted to talk about very quickly is to put this in perspective. Typically and historically, this was grouped under a intracranial bleed, right? Because it's in the head. That's the head. No, but this is an intracranial. Intracranial means inside the cranium. By definition, this is outside the cranium. So no, subgaleal hemorrhage, to be the most accurate, should not be grouped in terms of intracranial bleed because it is outside the cranium. It's outside the bony skull, right? It's outside the periosteum. The only kinds of intracranial hemorrhage for a child is either intraventricular. So let's work from the ventricles outward, right? So there's intraventricular bleed, of which there's different grades of that, 1 through 4. Then there's periventricular. So now it's getting into that, you know, grade 4 kind of bleed of the ventricles. There's intraparenchymal, where now it's truly into the brain tissue itself. And then there's subdural bleed. Those are the true intracranial bleeds. That's within the scalp itself, and some kind of throw in epidural because it's on top of the dura, but still within the bony skull. Right. So I get that it's more of an academic discussion, but if we're going to be accurate in reporting, we need to be accurate in reporting. Intraventricular, periventricular, intraparenchymal, and the dural bleed, subdural for sure, epidural sure. It depends on how you define intracranial. Is anything within the bony skull? Those are intracranial bleeds, right? Subdural hematoma is outside of the cranium, so this is a head bleed, but it's not, by definition, to be accurate, it's not really intracranial. Okay, so subgaleal bleed, let's do a little bit of pathophysiology here. Remember, we're talking about bleeding just underneath the scalp. Okay, this is under the aponeurosis of the scalp itself that rests with some connective tissue right on top of the periosteum of the skull. Okay, so this is above the periosteum of the skull, but underneath the aponeurosis called the gala. So hence the subgaleal bleed. So this is not in the skull. This is outside of the periosteum. And the reason this is dangerous is because that space is all potential space. This thing can cross suture lines because it's in the skin, all right? Unlike a cephalohematoma is accumulated underneath the periosteum of the bone. So because it's related to the bony structure, it's not going to cross suture lines. Everybody get that, right? So a cephalohematoma is a self-contained blood blotch, okay, a clot But it does not cross suture lines, so it's pretty well demarcated. Yes, that could be bad as well. There could be a relatively big volume, but it stopped. That's going to stop by itself. And outside of the breakdown and kernicterus and jaundice that can happen, it's pretty self-contained, okay? So cephalohematoma happens from the periosteum of the bone. That's a cephalohematoma. Caput succedaneum is within the soft tissue of the scalp itself, but that's just soft tissue edema. So caput, which is the cone head, caput succedaneum, not linked to any issues at all. It just gives you a little cone head as part of the natural molding process of the head. Not molding typically refers to the sliding of the skull bones, but it's the shape of the skin that happens as a result of going down the birth canal and just normal tissue response to pressure, which is edema. Now, that's different than the chignon. Okay, so C-H-I-G-N-O-N, the chignon happens specifically with a vacuum. So I've seen it, guys. I've caused it. So especially with a mushroom rigid cup. And this can happen even with one pull, all right? So now obviously it's much more likely to happen with prolonged vacuum time and multiple pulls, but sometimes just one, just even with a little outlet. Anytime you put vacuum on, you can get a chignon. Chignon is nothing more than specific, well-demarcated soft tissue swelling and even a little bit of fibrin deposition, a little bit of thrombin, a little bit of clots that form in there. But this is definitely just related to vacuum placed on the soft tissue of the head in and of itself. That's not linked to any morbidity, all right? So that well-demarcated little hat that you've given the baby because of a vacuum attempt is called the chignon. So I have to throw this out there just to be complete. Y'all get that chignon is really not an OB term? Do y'all get this? So if you have a daughter, you may or may not know this, but yeah, I'm sure you do. Chignon is actually a type of hairstyle, right? You put that little bun right on top. It kind of looks like a little, like a chignon. if you take a sweet roll and stick it on the back of your head, that's a chignon. So yeah, chignon, not necessarily just an OB term. It is a fashion term because it's a type of hair knot that goes into the head. So yeah, one of the side effects of doing a vacuum is that your baby gets a chignon hairstyle. Back to the subgaleal space, we talked about the fact that it is a potential space that can hold a lot of volume. So let me give you these volumes, and then we're going to go into the incidences. I've not forgotten about that because the numbers are pretty impressive here, all right? And again, this is not to strike fear in anybody. If you got to do a vacuum, do it. Just do it correctly. That's my point. Just do it and have respect for the procedure. This is not going to make me stop doing vacuums. I knew that this can happen. It's pretty rare. But once again, when it's taken out of the box of typical practice, it increases the risk of this occurring. Just use it with respect. That's the idea, all right? But if you do get a subgaleal hemorrhage, this is why this is tricky. Because first of all, the total blood volume in a child, which is based on weight, right? So big fat baby has more volume than a very skinny, scrawny little child. We all get that. It's the same as in any adult. But the typical blood volume of a child is around 80 mLs per kilo. Right, 80 mLs per kilo. So let's say you have a 3-kilo kid. So 80 per 3 kilos, we're talking about 240 mLs. Guys, 240 mLs of entire blood in a 3-kilo kid, that's not a lot. Y'all know that that's like less than a soda, right? So a soda has what, like 300, 350 mLs? So less than a can of soda is the amount of total term blood volume in a child. And of course, you don't have to lose all of that for the child to have severe decompensation and morbidity. And here's why this matters, because what's been reported is that breaking of these little emissary veins that start from the dura and then make their way up to the scalp veins and are found in this aponeurotic place. This happens, this subgaleal bleed happens with pulling away of the scalp from on top of the periosteum, right? So it's that pushing away, that vacuum away that causes little blood vessels to pop. And truly, there must be some of that happens with every vacuum. They're just really small and they're contained and nothing happens. But with a subgaleal hemorrhage, it gets out of control. So these little emissary veins that are in that epineurotic space can bleed a significant amount. There can be a significant dissection of this in the baby's head, and it goes all the way to the orbits. It goes back to the nape of the neck. It distorts the ear position because it goes back of the baby's ears. The baby is kind of lying on its back. Supine. So blood collects. That's why looking at the shape of the baby's head is super important. So if a baby has a vacuum-assisted delivery, you're not supposed to put on that little cap. Just leave it off. Yes, I need to get the baby gets cold, put it under a warmer, or put it on, but periodically check it. Every hour, they've got to check that baby's head to make sure that the baby's head isn't growing in dimensions or getting an abnormal texture to the scalp, right? And the reason this matters, remember we said, all right, so 80 mLs per kilo, term baby in general, so let's say 3 kilos, 240 mLs. All right, so remember that number. Now look at what published data has shown that potentially is in this space. You can literally put anywhere from 240 to 260 mLs of blood in that subepineurotic space. How about that? So a whopping amount of blood, like if not all of the blood volume, like 70% of the blood volume based on some publications, can actually go right into that space. Now remember that unlike a Chignon or a Caput Succedaneum, because this is kind of diffusing all under the epineuroses, you may not get a distinct little bump, all right? But it does cause an increase in head size. So an increase of about 1 centimeter is a lot. I mean, a centimeter, guys, even though that's considered mild, we're going to talk about the different grades here in a minute. Less than 1 centimeter of increase in head size can still be a significant amount of bleeding. And some, it depends on who you read, but some say about 50 to 70 mLs of blood at max, maybe 100 mLs of blood, which is still, again, not insignificant. But this is basically how you grade the amount, which is based on head size as well as ultrasound features. But it goes mild, moderate, and severe. We're going to talk about grading here in a minute. But it has to do with how much the head size grows in the first few hours. So less than 1 centimeter is typically mild. More than 3 centimeters is considered severe. And then with moderate and severe is the ones you got to really worry about for decompensation. That's pretty scary stuff, for sure. So now that we've laid down the scary, let's put things into perspective. Because if you remember we said in the intro, this is a rare, but if it happens, it could be really bad, all right? And not all subgaleal hemorrhages, guys, not all SGHs are terrible. They're not. They're mild, moderate, and severe. And thankfully, while subgaleal hemorrhage by themselves is rare, but not as rare, like I told you, it just happened to this poor baby here in this other institution, it is out there. So while the overall category is rare, having a very severe form of the condition is even more rare. So that's good news, okay? But here's what the numbers look like in terms of incidences. So these are the numbers. Out of published data, now that, the numbers kind of vary because it depends on your patient population, but you get the gist of it. In one publication from 2018, this happened 0.4 in 1,000 spontaneous vaginal deliveries without the use of vacuum or forceps. All right, so can it happen by itself? Absolutely. 0.4 per thousand. Again, rare. However, in cases where a vacuum was used, it was 5.9 per thousand. So when we talk about relative risk, that's a huge jump. However, the absolute number is still 5.9 per thousand, okay? But significantly higher than the spontaneous occurrence of 0.4 per thousand. So I wanted to put that in perspective. Another publication put it a different way. This was from a Journal of Perinatology from last year, 2023. Here's what these authors stated. Quote, the overall incidence of this is 1 in 7,000 live births with 1 in 598 vacuum-assisted births compared to 1 in 1,000 forceps-assisted births. Wow. So again, different numbers, but you get the gist of it, right? Spontaneous occurrence, just happened, you know, vaginal delivery, no issues, very, very darn rare, with the highest 0.4 per thousand, and then this one, 1 per 7,000, all to say, really small. The catch, though, is that vacuum-assisted is a multiplier effect, Okay. So whether you're talking about one in 598 or a 5.9 per thousand, the idea is vacuum is to be used when indicated, done correctly over the flexion point, which we're going to talk about next, but have a respect for it. Remember, we said that not all of them were severe, thankfully, but here's what the numbers look like when they do present. 6% of these cases are asymptomatic. 6%. Like, well, then how did you find it? Well, some protocols are routine cranial ultrasounds of the kid, head ultrasounds, although I don't like that because you can find stuff that really doesn't matter. But 6% are asymptomatic. 15 to 20% of these cases are mild. 40 to 50% are moderate. That's the majority here where they lie. And then 25 to 33% can be severe. But the catch is that even mild ones, you got to watch, because even though their need for blood transfusion and is less and their chance of hypovolemic shock is much lower, that 40 to 50% of moderate SGHs is where things can go spiraling down very quickly into the last category of severe. All right. So there's mild, moderate, and severe different grades of SGH. Podcast family, as we get ready to wrap this up, we just got to review the correct placement of the vacuum. I'm very vacuum friendly, which is interesting because I actually, believe it or not, I didn't use a vacuum until I finished residency, because Parkland was a straight up forceps. Man, I could get a kid out with some forceps, boy. I mean, whether it's Lucart Simpson, Straight Simpsons, Tucker McLean's. I mean, man, I had one on one side like a holster and then one on the other side. No, just kidding. But we were forceps friendly. And man, done correctly, that thing worked. And the reason back then that Dr. Lavino Cunningham really favored forceps over the vacuum is that, one, is it was less likely to fail. Number three, you really, if applied correctly, it protected the baby's head like a little cradle, although it tore up the pelvic floor. Remember, nothing's free, right? Vacuum is much more friendly on the mom's pelvic floor, but potentially more fetal issues. Correctly applied forceps, it tears up the pelvic floor, but protects the baby's head. So, you know, do what you will. By the way, so people have asked, which one is best? Well, the one that the operator, the physician, the provider is more comfortable with, for sure, with certain things in place. I mean, if you have a lot of asyncletism to correct, you can't do that with a vacuum. You need either manual rotation or put in forceps so that you can correct asyncletism with the blades. So there are some specifics that would say one would favor over the other. But if you don't have the experience with forceps, why would you don't experiment on the child? That's where you need to go to a sim center. Get some practice, some hands-on training first. So the correct answer of which one to do is the one that, number one, the provider's most comfortable with. And if it's really ill-advised, then get some help. Like if a baby's 32 weeks, please don't put a vacuum on that. Try not to do forceps on that either. I mean, is this extreme prematurity is a risk factor for complications. But know the rules, and again, use it appropriately, selectively, and with proper technique. Which brings us to this last part, which is placement of the cup. Correct placement of this little cup on the baby's head, on the scalp, is absolutely critical to success of this procedure. That's why it's called the flexion point. An incorrect placement can lead to issues, to say the least. So we'll try not to do that. But in general, you got to know where the anterior fontanelle is, of course, the posterior fontanelle, and that a sagittal suture. You need to know where that is, because that's exactly what's going to guide placement of this device. Okay, so in general, from the posterior to the anterior fontanelle, it's like 9 centimeters in general. We're talking about term children, okay? So in general, 9 centimeters. So the flexion point is on that sagittal suture. It's about 3 centimeters, which is we're talking about the middle of the cup, okay? Not the outer rim. The middle of the cup should be 3 centimeters from the posterior fontanelle. So if the distance between the posterior and anterior is 9, you take away 3, so that means 6 centimeters. There should be 6 centimeters from the dot, from the middle of the cup to the anterior fontanelle, okay? So people think of the centimeters, this guide, this 3 centimeters and 6 centimeters, as the distance from the outer rim of the cup. No. It's the center. The center of the cup is what we're talking about. That's the point called the flexion point. And in general, again, 3 centimeters in front of the posterior fontanelle, which means that the posterior fontanelle is going to be within the realm of the cup. Does that make sense? And then the middle of that cup should be 6 centimeters from the anterior fontanelle. based on some data, but not all, if that cup is less than, if that point is less than 3 centimeters from the anterior fontanelle, you can get a lot of pressure transmitted to the anterior fontanelle, which increases the risk of this occurring. Okay. So you want it to be directly in the middle, and you want it to be more on the backside. That's the easiest way to say it, okay? So the little point, the middle of the cup should be 3 centimeters from the posterior fontanelle, and the middle of the cup should be 6 centimeters from the anterior fontanelle. If you do the anything else, kind of over the parietal bones, anything more to the front, number one, it's not going to flex correctly. It increases your chance not only of cup detachment, but also of these potential neonatal complications. Now, I learned it some time ago that you went gentle application of the vacuum, right? One little press, two little press, three little press of the handle to get a slow vacuum. Yeah, it doesn't do anything. You can do that if you want to. You're just kind of wasting time, or just quick a vacuum initiation. There's no data that one is better than the other. Just like there's no real data that releasing the vacuum in between traction pulls is any safer. Although intuitively you would think it makes sense, but the data doesn't really show that. It's overall vacuum time. So you're super safe, less than 15 minutes. It gets kind of gray, 15 to 20, and over 20 of continuous vacuum, total vacuum time, that's too much, okay? Now, I like to release the vacuum in between. I just, why do I keep suction on the baby's head if I don't need to? And some reports have said, well, it's to prevent the baby from moving up. Well, damn, if the baby's moving up that much, maybe I shouldn't be doing vacuum. I mean, that's a bad sign. That's a dystocia waiting to happen. So I apply the vacuum, bring it down, make sure there's good downward descent, and then I release the vacuum, make sure it stays. Although, again, the data show, and ACOG supports the fact that whether you release the suction in between attempts or keep it on, as long as you adhere to the total vacuum time, has really not been linked to an increase in complications, assuming, of course, that the vacuum is placed correctly. So as we wrap this up, what have we learned? Vacuum and forceps, super important, super helpful when necessary. There's some that propose it universally as primary mode of delivery at C-section. Most would say, hold on there, Junior. Wait a minute. That's an instrument to be used when indicated versus electively. But, you know, you do you. And again, while very safe in the appropriate technique, subgaleal hemorrhage is something we should always be aware of. Always keep communication with the NICU. And guys, I know we're all busy, and I'm guilty of this too. We do a vacuum delivery or a forceps, and the baby's looks good. We're like, hey, 5-minute Apgar is good. Baby's crying. All right, moving all extremities, no problem. All right, I'm out of here. The truth is, it's always good to be in communication. I always tell our NICU staff or pediatric team, hey, look, you got to text me if something starts to look kind of funky here, because I want to be aware. Always good to document as well on postpartum day one. Hey, I followed the neonatal course. Doesn't seem to be an issue. This was uncomplicated. Now we can say it's an uncomplicated operative vaginal delivery when you've cleared the 12 and definitely the 24-hour mark. All right, podcast family, let's bring it home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.